Young Turks, Hannah Cranston here with Brett Ehrlich and Ambria Allen. You guys know Brett from Pop Trigger. Ambria, what are you up to now?
I am up to stand up per usual, and you know, if you want to enroll in a class at UCLA, you can look for me on the course website.
That's a good sell.
Yeah.
Can I do some like extension classes?
You can actually.
What are you teaching?
I teach like sociology of gender courses, gender and work, and some courses in the African American Studies department. Yeah. So.
That's
today I ate a full breakfast.
Oh,
it's my full. Was it my list
square?
Of accomplishments. It's a square meal, but okay. Nothing nearly as impressive as what you just
said.
Well,
you know,
right?
Yeah. Well, that's the benefits of, you know, working as a professor at a university. You could do that too.
I doubt it.
Yeah,
I think you could
someday.
You got the look.
Yeah, I have one of those like shoulder, like elbow pad professor
Ooh.
Jackets.
Oh. Then you're ready.
That's it.
That's all you need.
Yeah, and be flustered, and you're fine.
Yeah, I have like the NPR stammer down. sort of. I say sort of a lot instead
yeah.
of.
Yeah, instead
a
of an actual. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
You're in there.
I sort of.
I think you're ready.
Yeah. Hi, everybody.
Yeah. Well, we are going to be talking more about some things at universities today to start this hour off. But we have a ton of great stories for you guys. We're going to talk about the fact that Breitbart and InfoWars are trying to blame the California wildfires on an interesting suspect. And we are going to talk about a weird conspiracy theory going around that Melania Trump has a body double. So stick around. But first, for our biggest story of the day, let's talk about Richard Spencer. Alt-right and neo-Nazi leader Richard Spencer spoke at the University of Florida today, but unfortunately, due to protests, his speech got cut a little short, and he was upset that he was being booed. Now, Florida had been preparing for this event for the entire week and for weeks to come up to this speech. In fact, on Monday, Florida Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency where the university is located to enable law enforcement agencies to work together more efficiently. He also made a provision for the National Guard to be activated if necessary. Now, the university prepared for the event as well. In fact, University of Florida President W. Kent Fuchs denounced Spencer's white supremacist platform as abhorrent in a letter to students, but said that the school could not stop him from renting the Phillips Center for the event because it's a public university. Now, by law, the school also has to pay for any additional costs of security. And given the heightened concerns, the school is providing extra security that exceeds $600,000, which is a lot of money. And taxpayers are going to have to pay for that because it's a public university. The president said, "I really don't believe that's fair that the taxpayer is now subsidizing through these kind of events, the security and having to subsidize his hate speech." All right. Mm-hmm. Now, leading up to the event, Richard Spencer was aware that the state of emergency was enacted. He was aware of the police and the protesters that were preparing, and he was eating it up. In an interview with CNN, he said that he was flattered by the state of emergency declaration, which he said put him on par with hurricanes and invading armies and zombie apocalypses. Which just tells you what kind of swell guy he is. And so Richard Spencer is obviously a douchebag, one. And two, a huge proponent of—
Confirmed. Confirmed. I can confirm.
Checks out. A huge proponent of freedom of speech, right? That's what they try. They use that as a guise for their hate speech, right? But what's interesting, though, is in preparation for this event, Richard Spencer hand-selected the press that was allowed into the event so that he could control the spin that was being played for his speech. Reporters who had signed up to cover Spencer's event received an email on Wednesday from the university telling them that all media credentialing decisions are made by the NPI, which refers to the National Policy Institute, which is the neo-Nazi think tank that is run by Spencer. So that's a very interesting twist in this story, and I definitely want to get into that because I do think that that's sort of ironic given what Spencer stands for and the conversation that he has around free speech. But first, I want to show you guys a video from the national reporter from the HuffPost. He was in the auditorium when Spencer was speaking, and you can hear students chanting, "Go home, Spencer." In other videos, you can hear them chanting that Nazis are not welcome here. And Spencer's response is kind of interesting. Take a look.
The most important free speech event, perhaps of our lifetime. This is where the rubber hits the road with the question of the First Amendment and free expression. This is where the rubber hits the road. Free speech is a meaningless concept.
All right, so a few things that I want to clarify. The people in the back are putting up the Black Power fist. They're not putting up, like, it's hard to tell right from the video, especially in that kind of crowd. You don't know if people are raising one hand, what kind of salute they're doing. So that's what they were doing. And you can see the space between all the empty chairs, and that's the space between the protesters in the back that were separated by the chairs, separated by police, and then presumably supporters of Spencer who were in the front. We can't see them, any of them, but presumably they were there.
I have seen them. Snapchat has a map feature, which if you pinch your face when you're taking a selfie, you reveal the map. You then go to Gainesville right now, which is where the University of Florida is, and you can look all over campus. Today, all over campus at the University of Florida was a ghost town, except for the quick response forces, which are guys in, you know, tan, like, long sleeve shirts.
Really quick on that, I just want to, right before the show, Kimberly Archer from University of Florida emailed me saying, can you cover this story? Like, this is crazy. She said that students were afraid to set foot on campus and that a bunch of professors canceled classes because they were terrified of violence.
You can see,
I mean, that's absurd.
You can see inside classrooms where multiple students have just posted, like, there's no one here today. I guess I didn't get the memo. But inside the event, you can also see someone posted a snap from the balcony looking down, and there's about 20. There's about 20 Richard Spencer people.
Yeah.
Compare that to the scores of folks outside. Actually, Snapchat, they have, like, they go together and they group different events, and they give it a little title, and you can see a little thumbnail. It started with Richard Spencer event, and then they changed it to an edited featured video called, and it displaced the Richard Spencer event, and it was replaced with protesting racism at Gainesville.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think
that's powerful.
I think it's interesting because a lot of folks did opt to not go, including folks who actually did want to attend the event, who were scared to attend the event. So a lot of folks opted to watch it online. I guess that was an option. So I think what this means symbolically is great, but it doesn't mean that folks still aren't interested in this message.
Yeah, and I don't think that's necessary. I mean, we have seen clearly, like, we saw at Charlottesville, we see online on a daily basis that folks are interested in this message, right? But what I think is really interesting, right, is that he, you know, before the event, right, he wanted to essentially stifle, like, the freedom of the press, right? He wanted to pick and choose whom was allowed in the room and could cover the event. And then he claimed that during the speech, he said, "You're trying to stifle our free speech," while people were booing. And it's like, we also have freedom to protest, freedom to assemble. And it's like, just because you have free speech doesn't mean you have the freedom to be heard. Like, the problem is those voices are louder, thank God, than you. And you don't, that just because you can't be heard and you decided not to speak through the boos doesn't mean you still don't have freedom of speech. So sorry, not sorry.
The voices are so much louder than the folks he had there. He was selling tickets. And you can, there is a small group in the front, which is completely just, you know, dwarfed in numbers by the folks that are inside, outside. Yeah. There, you can see people outside. They had some amazing chants, one of which was just no violence.
Yeah.
When things started to get testy, the crowd would chant no violence.
Yeah.
Things like, you know, Richard Spencer, go home, Nazis not welcome here. There was someone translating the chants into sign language for people who were hearing impaired to say you're welcome. And then all over campus, people had put up, fraternities had put up signs that said we're about love and not hate. Sure. Someone had just printed out "you're loved" on a bunch of pieces of white paper. Wow. And it's all over campus. Yeah. Someone went through and just panned around and showed all the outpouring of support. And it's in multiple languages, including German and English and Spanish.
Just in case someone wants to.
Yeah, just like
switch sides.
So I feel like we have the good guys have won here.
Sure.
The fight's not over, but just, it is impossible to say that Richard Spencer and the message of hate have won when there are so many positive voices out there who seem to, and this is as of the, you know, an hour ago, who seem to have kept it mellow and spread a message of love and told the Nazis that they're not welcome there.
No, and I think that's really profound, and I think that's very important. And just again, like, you can, you have the freedom to stand on a soapbox wherever you want and say what you want in this country. And I, you know, I stand firmly behind freedom of speech, and I will protect that right, even if I don't agree with you. That said, we don't have to listen to you
or pay for it. Like, the universities need to consider some kind of logistical solution to funding, right, these kinds of forums, right? So I know he had to pay to rent this space. Should that cost be inclusive of the additional security that you require, because you are this volatile public identity? You need to fit the bill, or fit the bill for, you know, the added security and all the measures that, you know, we need to provide, because you've decided that this is the space that you want to kind of present your ideas in. So
that's a really good point as well. The girl who emailed me, the viewer who emailed me, who is a student there, said, look, I'm paying for a service, presumably. I'm paying for an education. Mm-hmm. And now I'm also paying to have this person spew hateful rhetoric.
So there's a lot of talk about safe spaces in America. Because safe space is just a term.
Right.
People can use that term differently.
Sure. Right.
And I think a university is a safe, it should be a safe space for your body.
Mm-hmm.
Should be a, you should be safe there.
Yeah.
It should not it should be a safe space, not from ideas, but a safe space for the exchange of ideas.
Sure. Yes.
So when it comes to having Richard Spencer there, that I'm fine with him going and speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such a weird dynamic that the president of the university can now say, well, he's in charge of so much because he essentially just paid to rent the space out.
Right. He paid to rent the space out, and then he chose his press. So if he's choosing which people are allowed in to cover it, wouldn't you say, like, that's sort of a safe space?
Yeah, absolutely. And but the other thing is, part of his strategy is to have this discussion specifically.
Right.
Now, I'm perfectly fine giving in to him having this discussion, or really any discussion, because our ideas are better than his. Mm-hmm. But he wants to have that discussion of, oh, everyone's mad that, like, this isn't getting covered right. And that they don't want me here. They're classifying me the same way as a hurricane. Other things that are part of his strategy is naming his think tanks called the National Policy Institute.
Right.
Which is so intellectually dishonest and frighteningly benign sounding.
Right.
I feel like
that's his shtick. He just changes like the names of awful, I mean, he's changed the Nazi movement into the alt-right.
Right.
That's his shtick, is just like rebranding.
Yeah, and
he's a marketer.
Not just him. Yeah, he's avoiding, like, the common pitfalls of regular, average, garden variety, traditional white supremacists.
Is he?
Which are, like, himself personally wearing swastikas. And, you know, there's one interview that I read about a guy, I think we all saw this, which was, there's a guy who's like a, you know, more Nazi type white supremacist who said, he doesn't go as far as I want. He doesn't talk about the Zionist owned media much. And he also, his group has issued, in advance of events, guidelines for, like, how to dress nice so people call us dapper.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they're trying to expand the idea or the framework for what it means to present as a white supremacist, right?
Yeah.
To, again, kind of reduce the stigma of kind of these historical depictions that we have of white supremacists. But then, you know, you walk down marching, you know, hollering blood and soil with torches. Like, you're calling on those past ghosts. So I think there is a way in which they are trying to, again, rebrand. And they're even being covered in that way. I remember Richard Spencer being, like, cast as somebody who was fashion forward. And it's like, okay, but his ideas are backwards. So, like, where are we? Why are we doing this? So a ton of questions, a lot of nuance, I think, with this movement. And I think it's interesting that this is happening alongside the recent declaration that black identity extremists are now the number one, like, terrorist, national terrorist threat, right? But this is the group where we've got to call, you know.
Then we have to call a state of emergency.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's like, who really is the domestic security threat?
Yeah.
So there's one. Did we report the alligator brewery? The plan. There was a brewery in Gainesville, or you know, around the University of Florida that said, all right, so Richard Spencer's coming to town. And ahead of that, he is selling tickets. Now, we at the Gator Brewery would like to tell you, since he has a limited number of tickets, go buy the tickets, bring them here, and we'll give you a free beer for every ticket that you bring.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Richard Spencer got wind of this and changed the time that he was selling tickets to closer to the actual time of the event, but they're still like.
They also tried to do some other like weird shady things with the ticket so that like people who were like real supporters would also have access, but like the protesters couldn't all just buy them out.
Make sure no bots are buying tickets. But
you didn't need to, you didn't have enough people to fill like an auditorium, and that's a good thing.
That's a very good thing. Yeah. All right, moving on. In the wake of the devastating wildfires in Northern California that have left 42 people dead and 200,000 acres completely destroyed, there are some right-wing websites that are blaming an undocumented immigrant for the fires in completely false and completely unsubstantiated headlines. So take a look at some of these. Breitbart said, ICE detainer issued for suspected wine country arsonist in Sonoma jail. So we have that one. And then we have this one here from American News 24/7. Report homeless arsonist behind California wildfire that killed 40 people is an illegal alien. So before I get into the story, no human is illegal, thank you very much. But these rumors flared after officials arrested a 29-year-old man in Maxwell Farms Regional Park last weekend. Now his name is Jesus Fabian Gonzalez, and he's a homeless man that is known to deputies. And he had started a fire to keep warm, all right? Now, according to the Sonoma County Sheriff, Rob Giordano, he says that there's a story out there that he's the arsonist in these fires. And he says that's not the case. There's no indication he's related to these fires at all. I wanted to kill that speculation right now so we didn't have things running too far out of control. Now, before we get into some of the details of this, this fire that he started, that he admits to starting, he says that he started this fire to warm himself up. He tried to extinguish some of it, and then the deputies that found him extinguished the majority of the fire before even firefighters came up. This happened just the other on Tuesday, and then the Sonoma fires started over a week ago. So just timeline-wise, their facts are a little muddy. But they posted that on Monday that he had been arrested, but hours later, Breitbart and the right wing picked up the story, all right? But here's like the really, really interesting part about this story is that the Sonoma County Sheriff, Sergeant Spencer Crum, said that when he got calls from Breitbart News and InfoWars, all they asked about was Gonzalez's ethnicity and whether ICE had placed a detainer on him. They didn't ask any follow-up questions about whether or not they thought he was the arsonist. They just ran with that story. And then, of course, people on Facebook, people on Twitter ran with this story. So there's this entire conspiracy theory that an undocumented immigrant was an arsonist, and that's why we can't have sanctuary cities and sanctuary states. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Nice scapegoat, though.
Yeah, it's crazy how quickly it escalates.
Yeah. You're talking,
and how it's ironic, like it's a wildfire story that it just catches on that fast. And that's all they need is like there are things that happen that they kind of have a filter out for. Oh, does it involve like a big story people are talking about? Is there anything that randomly kind of involves any other wedge issue we're trying to push? Yeah. Mm. If they overlap ever, oh, now we have our spin on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you see the way it goes from Breitbart to American 24.
How it travels.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And I think this story was receiving very little attention by conservative media until they could attach this narrative to it, which I think is just unfortunate. And I pine for the day we can return to objective reporting.
So I have been reading Breitbart, and I've been trying.
Are you okay? Do you need anything?
No, because I think it's important to understand what the other side is reading, right? And so I've been looking at it, and these articles are and the headlines are so clickbaity, right? They do a very good job at making clickbaity articles. And so I've been clicking on them like, oh, no way this can be true. I get sucked into it too. No way this can be true. And then you click on it and you read the article. And oftentimes the article has nothing to do with the headline. And they'll say somebody, it's like when TMZ says, so-and-so like says that tells this bitch to like step off. And like the person did not say that in the interview. Like they just come up with BS explanations. And they're banking on the fact that the readers aren't reading the article, that they're seeing the headline and sharing that. That's what they're banking on. Because if you look into these articles, even they're oftentimes not even addressing the headline. They'll say that there's an arsonist, and they'll like imply that it's related to the Sonoma fires, but they don't go into and give any actual facts that it's there.
Because if you look at this one, it's like ICE detainer issued for suspected wine country arsonist in Sonoma jail. So the idea was someone called that there was a fire.
Right.
The location is wine country. Mm-hmm. This guy's did ICE issue a detainer? We don't know, but there's something happened there.
Diagramming a sentence. Where is the noun? Yeah,
but it's like it's all yeah. all those words. That's the thing.
It's a formula.
They create a word cloud.
Yeah.
And it's weird. Like there's this one. There was a while back. There was some kind of like. New York Times thing about what happens at Breitbart. And very often they said that they cover their bases in a number of ways. They do, salacious headlines, but if you come after them, technically the article doesn't have all those things that the headline
implies.
They're
very, very careful about
and
that.
And they'll like hire people of, the ethnicity that this one goes after.
Sure.
So they say they're like, I have a Muslim.
Yeah.
Instead of a Muslim friend, it's a Muslim editor. Mm. Like I have a real lot of Muslim editors.
They read this, they vetted it, and it's fine.
It's frustrating. Something interesting that's happening in Italy.
Okay.
Is Italy on October 31st is going to start having it's 8,000 schools or something is going to have a fake news curriculum that they teach to their kids in partnership with Facebook and other companies like that. Mm-hmm. They are going to
give
kids
Facebook
in partnership with Facebook. So Facebook obviously, whether they're going out and earnestly trying to stop this or it's a PR stunt, I don't care.
I
like that it's happening, and
I
that's
agree.
What happens when we all put pressure on people to act better.
Sure.
So they are going to launch this, and they're giving kids like a bunch of different things they can do when they see a story. And I like that they're doing it with kids because that's great. I want the children are our future. I think they should do it with grownups.
Because I
think one of the problems is like people think that if they see something in a headline format with an article after it, it's news. I feel like now it's just like so trite to say, but it's worth it saying they're having kids call experts, re-report the story and fix it.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
No, I do think that's very important. I think that's amazing. Really quick, I want to go circle back to this story about the Sonoma wildfires. Because even though some of these right-wing outlets tried to use undocumented immigrants as a scapegoat, people in Northern California, officials in Northern California, have actually been very welcoming to undocumented immigrants. And they said that if they do go to shelters during this, there will be no ICE officials there. They said that they'll be safe and that they don't have to worry about that while they're fleeing the fire. So I do think that's important to note. We're gonna take a quick break right now, but we'll be right back and see you guys in a few. All right, back on the Young Turks, Hannah here with Brett and Ambria. We're gonna do two more stories and then we're gonna take another break, but we'll be back after that. So for those of you guys that are watching online, stick around. And now we're just gonna jump right in. A 9-month-old baby who is being treated for aggressive brain cancer received a letter addressed to the infant from the insurance company saying that his coverage was denied. Now, this is a picture here of the adorable Connor Richardson. And now the insurance company sent this little nugget a letter that says, "Dear Connor Richardson, as HIP Health Plan of New York, we try hard to provide you with access to quality healthcare services that meet your needs. When we decide to deny coverage for treatment or service, we want to make sure you know why. We have decided to deny coverage for inpatient hospitalization to St. Jude Hospital from 10-4 to 10-10. We have determined that the services are not medically necessary. And then somewhere in the middle of the letter, they switch font and then they start talking to the parent in sort of a bizarre change of person. They say that your child is a 9-month-old boy who was diagnosed with a high-grade brain tumor. Your child was treated with surgical remover of his tumor at Stony Brook Hospital. After your son was discharged, you enrolled him in a clinical trial at St. Jude's Hospital. Evidence-based guidelines do not exist to confirm its effectiveness for his brain tumor. Therefore, this request for clinical trial treatment to St. Jude's Hospital is not medically necessary and is denied. Then they changed the typeface again and said, if you decide to have this service, you may have to pay it yourself. Which is just a lovely message to send a 9-month-old boy who can't read it and who is suffering from aggressive brain cancer. But fortunately for this family, St. Jude is a rare medical institution that offers its services at no charge, even supplying patients and their families with transportation and food vouchers. Connor has embarked on his chemotherapy with no cause for his family to worry about the expense. So this story does have a semi-happy ending here in that this child will continue to receive treatment and the parent don't have to worry about the exorbitant medical costs of undergoing this trial and undergoing chemotherapy. But this letter just shows you how messed up our healthcare system is and how badly we need single payer. I mean, it just is such a glaring example. When you see the face, can we show the baby again? Can we show Kimball? Yeah, I mean, when you see that face and there's pictures of this like little just sweetheart like glaring up at his father, it's just the sweetest thing. Like I was reading this article and going through this and I was in tears. And it just made me so frustrated at the state of our healthcare in this country right now. And then I was, you know, encouraged and happy to read the end about St. Jude's and how they carry on their medical services. But for babies around the country and people around the country, they're not so lucky.
Yeah. You said it changed font. What it changed font to was the only thing an individual contributed to this form letter. That's what's so annoying. Is it's so little of it has any, you know, personal impact. And some medical crisis like this is one of the most personal things you can go through. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, personal, but like it is one of the most heart-wrenching, sensitive areas. And your healthcare provider to just swoop in and write the letter, dear 9-month-old baby.
Right, yeah.
It makes you sick. It's very frustrating. I understand that there are limits to what a healthcare provider covers. Like I get it. And I understand that there are certain experimental treatments that are so experimental and, you know, out of left field that a company's gonna say like, you know, I'm not gonna cover your weird potion that you're putting together. That's what that's for. But this is St. Jude's, and this is St. Jude's using something that got to this level. So, in the very minimum, they need to stop using the term medically necessary because it implies that it's not necessary medically to save this kid's life.
Right. Right. And I think that's the issue that I have with the language is that it's very conflicting, right? They argue that it's not medically necessary, but then also later argue that they're denying coverage because it's not medically effective, right? But then they call it a life-saving treatment.
Yeah.
So what is it, right? So you need to prove your case. You need to do it better and it needs to be consistent. And also insert a little humanity inside of the letter and that would also go a long way. But I think, again, it's carving out the boundaries for why you're not providing coverage for this child.
And one of the other frustrating things is it doesn't have really to be anything because the only folks overseeing whether they're going to cover your insurance claim is someone who works inside and for an insurance company. Mm-hmm. And the only way they're going to expand, contract, whatever their coverage is if they feel pressure from outside sources like you and me, or if they feel like it's going to cost them money not to.
I mean, that's what this comes down to, and that's what's so frustrating is, like, I get that healthcare is a business, right? Like, I understand that component of it, but like at the same time, like, I don't know, like, how any sort of person with any sort of empathy or whatever could look at this case or look at so many cases and have just no care in the world and just be like, well, it doesn't help my bottom line. You know what I mean?
That's what it is.
That is what it is. This is like just like capitalism at its very, very worst.
Which is, and it's not fair because there is an inelastic demand for being alive.
Right.
Yeah. And most things, if it's more expensive, I'm not going to buy as much because like I don't want it enough.
Right.
But here, you never change how much you want to be alive, theoretically. And so you'll pay literally infinite dollars in order to stay that way. And that's where they get you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're making these parents choose essentially between, I mean, luckily not in this case, but in so many cases, they make the parents essentially choose between like, you know, pulling out a mortgage or whatever they have to do to afford these sorts of clinical trials or to afford to keep their child alive. I mean, to really put that burden and to put that decision on a parent or anybody to stay alive, to help sick kids or whomever is so wrong.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's infuriating. And like, I mean, I do want to get into the fact that we can avoid something like this with a single payer system, right? Like if the government presumably is helping fund some of these things, it won't be up to these private insurance companies to then get to deem, oh, this doesn't help our bottom line, right? Then everybody is essentially taken care of.
You know, it depends on your faith in the system.
Sure.
Because there might also, you know, single payer, you can say single payer, it is all about the execution of any thing. I mean, my friends who are from, you know, countries that have single payer say, no, it's awesome. Like you show up and that's it. And you leave with medicine and it's great.
Yeah.
So you can execute it right. We need to get to something that's better than this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. We do need we just need to figure it out because I think there's stories like this, right? We can talk about healthcare, we can watch debates on healthcare and all of that stuff. But I think when you have more tangible stories and you make it a little bit more human, then hopefully these sorts of stories can hit home a little more, you know, and people can start to understand the necessity of this, the urgency of this.
Yeah.
And hopefully our administration will act accordingly. I mean, you know, when we're looking at like how the administration's dealing with healthcare now and how they're trying to reduce subsidies and things like that, it's very frustrating.
Right. That's
to watch.
That's what kills you. Is, I mean, literally.
Mm-hmm. Literally, it kills you.
And the lack of any consistent message telling us like this is our strategy for moving forward on healthcare. Right now, it's just someone who says like we need a new deal. And in the meantime, I'm going to break the toy I have.
Sure. Yeah. There is no effective strategy and there is no effective leadership that's kind of guiding this process, which is unfortunate.
Yes. All right, guys. We are going to come back in a minute for those of you that are watching online. We'll come back with a few stories, one of which is my favorite story of the day that some women, have some guidance for you as to how to avoid sexual harassment and abuse. So you're gonna wanna stay tuned for that because I have some pretty heated opinions on it. So stick around for that. And France is making a new law that might fine catcallers, which I think we could use in this country as well. We'll see you guys right after the break. All right, back on the Young Turks, and we're gonna jump into this next story. While it may seem that every woman on your newsfeed has come out with her own Me Too story in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal, some women have advice for other women as to how to avoid sexual harassment or sexual abuse, and that's to stop asking for it with the way that you dress. According to Representative Eddie Bernice Johnson, who is a Democrat in Texas, she said that she grew up in a time when it was as much the woman's responsibility as it was a man's. How you were dressed, what your behavior was. I'm from the old school that you can have behaviors that appear to be inviting. It can be interpreted as such. That's the responsibility, I think, of the female. She then goes on to say, I think we also need to start talking about the power that women have to control the situation. There's law enforcement. You can refuse to cooperate with that kind of behavior. I think that many times men get away with this because they are allowed to get away with it by the women. And this isn't the only woman that's come out with some rhetoric like this. In fact, if you remember last week, Big Bang Theory's Mayim Bialik wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. Now, I will say a disclaimer that she has apologized for it since. But in that op-ed, she writes, I have decided that my sexual self is best reserved for private situations with those I am most intimate with. I dress modestly. I don't act flirtatiously with men as a policy. And this was her going on to explain why she herself has not been sexually assaulted. And another woman who has also apologized profusely, Donna Karan, during an interview said, you look at everything all over the world today. And how women are dressing and what they are asking by just presenting themselves the way they do. What are they asking for? Trouble. So before we jump into, I think, some of the specifics of these quotes and how messed up they are and how they illustrate how ingrained some of these power dynamics and sexist beliefs and victim blaming are in our society and in our culture, I would just like to say for all the women and for all the men out there, it does not matter how naked you are or how revealing you are dressed or how sexual you are. That is not providing consent to touch my body. That is not providing consent to abuse my body. That is not providing consent to make salacious comments about my body. And so for these women to perpetuate these old school beliefs that were effed up then and are effed up now is really disappointing. But it shows you how ingrained, even in women, these sorts of ideals and these sorts of notions can become and have become.
I mean, yes. The Eddie Redmayne Johnson, whatever her name is, Eddie Bernice Johnson.
Bernice, yes.
Not Eddie Redmayne, who's an actor.
Yes.
Really talented actor. Mm. Is essentially just saying, hey, guys rape. You know they rape and it's in there, they do it. And if you don't want him to rape you, just wear a sweater. Like that's what she's saying.
Uh-huh.
And that's messed up. What I think you try to wade through for the sensical thing in the nonsensical thing. So there's two different, there's like the way things are and handling that. Mm-hmm. And then there should be a, let's get to the way things should be. And whenever I hear the way that women I know deal with the way things are, it makes me really sad.
Yes.
My friend Olivia lived in San Francisco, and every day, like the way she would walk around in San Francisco, she'd have to wear a hoodie, sunglasses, and headphones, even though she wasn't listening to anything.
Yeah.
So she could pretend not to hear it.
But mm-hmm. you also have to be self-aware in case someone does try
to
attack
you. You have to have your headphones down because you have to be listening for what's going on around you. I mean, when you think about the cognitive resources that you use on a daily basis as a woman to avoid any sort of sexual harassment, any sort of sexual assault. It is absurd. Like I could walk you through my day. Like I didn't go for a run this morning outside because it got light later in the day. You know what I mean? It's like, yes, I'm taking that protective measure because that's the reality of the world that we live in. But if God forbid something was gonna happen while I was on a run, for anybody to say, well, you shouldn't have run in the dark, like F you, like I should be able to do that. Unfortunately, I'm not able to do that. And I made the choice not to do that. But then like, there's not a single day that like I've parked not in the parking lot of our studio, I've parked around the block or something like that. Every single time I've parked around the block, I've been harassed without fail. Without fail.
My wife doesn't go to the beach alone. She just doesn't because she can't. Just because of, and it's like, I don't know, it's not even like it's connected with like a, necessarily with like the desire of a guy to have sex with her. It's just this weird presumption that you just can, that you can just yell at her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like it. There's also this thing about like, a lot of folks have said like, you know, you don't need a daughter to have to say like, oh, you know, I have a daughter, so now I can speak with it. But there are folks who go after that person. My response is, I don't care how you got there.
Just
I don't care if it took having a daughter. I don't care if it took having a wife.
Right.
It shouldn't. It shouldn't take
you
having
shouldn't
a daughter.
Take that. You should just be human.
But just get there.
Yeah.
Let's
yeah.
all get there.
Yeah.
Eddie, Representative Johnson. Get there.
Yeah, I just really quick, I just want to talk about a few things within her statement. Talking about law enforcement, there's a ton of reasons why women don't go to law enforcement, because they're oftentimes not believed, they're oftentimes intimidated, they're oftentimes fearful of retaliation. You can refuse to cooperate with that kind of behavior. Yeah, of course you can refuse to cooperate, but if you listen to the Harvey Weinstein tape, you can hear him coercing, you can hear her trying to refuse. Also, there's this thing called rape where people force themselves upon you. And so even if you're refusing to cooperate, it still can happen to you.
Sure. Men have found myriad ways to sexually harass women that don't kind of fit into this box of what we understand as rape, right? With the Weinstein case, in terms of like masturbating in the room while they're, you know what I mean? So there are a number of ways in which you can assault my personhood. That don't, you know, fit into this framework of what we understand as rape, you know, and that's right. why they're having a hard time prosecuting a lot of these cases
yeah.
because we have a narrow definition of what sexual assault is. And just to the earlier point, I think women already understand the undue burden of like self-protection.
Yeah.
So I think these op-eds from Miriam and this statement from, I mean, Bernice is just problematic and very much disconnected from a progressive gender politic. Miriam is interesting because we see that this generational
Mayim.
Blossom. Mm-hmm. Because we see this generational detachment, right? So Bernice is 50s, and here we are in this modern time, and she's kind of espousing some of the same beliefs that this woman a generation before her. It's the same argument.
Yeah. Well, and I think some of that, I mean, she goes into the article, she goes in the op-ed that she learned that from her parents. And I do think that comes from the generation prior. I remember I was on a field trip when I was in eighth grade, and I was on a field trip with my class, and this man came and groped me. And I told the teacher, because I was terrified as a 13-year-old, and she was like, well, you are wearing shorts. That's what I was told as an eighth grader, that I was wearing, oh, well, you decided to wear shorts. Like, no, that's not what we should be telling young girls. That is so beyond messed up, and we need to move past that as a society.
Sure.
We really,
gotta shift the messaging to what boys need to learn, what men need to learn about women's bodies and their access to women's bodies, so that women aren't consistently problematized for just being, for just existing.
I mean,
and
that's
making
the
choices.
Thing. Yeah, I mean, that's what she's saying, is like, oh, you can refuse to cooperate. It's like, no, like, I go about my day, I'm not doing anything, I'm consistently sexually harassed on Twitter and on my Instagram. I'm not cooperating with that.
Right, you don't even
I'm minding my own business.
Yeah, you don't even have to physically be in the space to be sexualized, right? So, again, this is a nuanced conversation that we need to nuance our thoughts about how we approach it, because it's ridiculous, this arcane notion that, you know, my skirt was too short, so Bill came on to me. It's like, that's not, you know, wholly how sexual harassment and assault operates.
Yeah, people are assaulted in short skirts and they're assaulted in ski suits. Unfortunately, that's just how it happens. Moving on. France is looking to make catcalling a crime and fine offenders. Now, on Monday, October 16th, Marlene Schiappa, France's junior minister of gender equality, said that France was exploring the idea of fining individuals for street sexual harassment and how much the fines would cost. Now, Schiappa said the government was going to consult with professionals on the legalities of such a proposal and create workshops for citizens across the country. Now, this all came about after France's version of the hashtag MeToo, but their hashtag was expose your pig, because France is awesome. Because France is awesome. So, you know, they haven't obviously made this into law yet, but they're looking into it. And I don't know how it would be enforced, right? I mean, presumably, if you are being catcalled and you're on the street, you know, next to a man and you confront him, that's a danger, right? Or, you know, staying nearby and calling the police, that's also a danger because you're presenting a physical danger for yourself. So I'm not sure how this would work practically, but I do think it's important to recognize that they're trying to take steps into the right direction.
Legally, a lot of this is covered in American law. Legally, It should technically, you're protected against this kind of behavior. Usually it's under a disturbing the peace statute. New York, for example, I mean, the wording of these are pretty hilarious, but I mean, they're strange. It's like obscene language or gestures in public. If they do it at least twice, they're up for a $250 fine and 15 days in jail. Alaska, Arizona, Colorado, Georgia, Kentucky, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania, it's illegal to follow people. It's not illegal to catcall them or do what I just said happens in New York, which is illegal, but you can't follow people. DC, abusive language or conduct, or disturbing a person's path. So a lot of these places have this nebulous idea. So there, the law is on the books in a lot of places.
Yeah.
But the ability to then document that effectively, go to a police officer and tell them that's what happened, that's another story.
Yeah, I think that's the question, is like, how do you operationalize these kinds of laws? And I think there are other models for kind of how to implement this. I think Portugal has like some stuff on the books, and Belgium. So France has models to kind of frame this legislation around. But again, how do you do it? I do think there is something to having these offenses categorized under sexual harassment or sexual assault, as opposed to,
disturbing the peace.
Because I think it creates, a framework for kind of understanding that these are gender-based offenses, right? Like, and I think might stigmatize some of the offenders. And I wish there was a way to make it like public record,
so you could, that's like, interesting.
So you could like look up before you go on a date with someone, how many times have they catcalled?
Like, does everyone need a body cam?
Right.
To be like, all right, here's my trip today.
Yeah, how do you exactly
walking around? And I, in Iowa or in Hawaii, it's like after you tell them to stop and they don't, they're up for $1,000 and 30 days in prison. Here's my video from my body camera.
But guess what? Telling somebody to stop while you're on the street, whether you're by yourself, is a real danger. Like that's something that can be very, like if you're in already an intimidating situation, already having sort of that like precursor to the take the neck before you can get to the next step is problematic in itself. Because if I'm on the street and there's a man coming towards me who's probably got another 100 pounds on me, you know what I mean? He's twice my size, and he says something inappropriate to me, and I don't necessarily see that I have a safety net of people around me with eyes or can hear me or whatever, and I tell him to stop, I'm putting myself in a really precarious situation.
Yeah, I think women learn to de-escalate, right? As uncomfortable as those situations are, we learn to de-escalate for fear of, violent encounters. So I wonder, like, who would be trained? Like, are cops supposed to intervene when they see this happening? Like, because I don't trust that at all.
I think cops catcall me.
Right. So it's like, how do you operationalize this? And how do you train folks to kind of identify that it's happening? Is this something that we collectively do as citizens, like, calling it out?
Yeah.
Right now is a watershed moment, hopefully, in this all, in that the Harvey Weinstein thing's in the zeitgeist today. We covered two stories. I hope it continues this way.
Yeah.
But the sad part about that is like, well, then we have to expose more and more stuff that has happened.
Right.
But I think collectively we all understand it happens a whole hell of a lot.
Of course.
All the time, multiple times on your street a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, one of my favorite things that has come out of this, like, of the Harvey Weinstein things, that more people are realizing how ubiquitous it is, right? Like, I've had guys be like, wait, like, I know guys that have been accused of this. I'm like, I know you may know that one guy, but you probably know a lot more. You just don't know that they do it. Like, my guess is a big portion of your friends do it because it's so common.
The problem now, one of the many problems, is that with that thing we talked about in a previous story about Representative Johnson, is that the women are afraid and the guys aren't. They aren't afraid of any consequence. And there is no fear of consequence. So whatever we need to do to up, I think, the fear of consequence, at the very least, in addition to just raising people better, that's gonna take. So there's long term, there's short term things we can do, and a renewed push in litigating against these kinds of things, making sure they go through. There's so many people who are complicit in this, who have let it go on for so long.
Yeah. Including our education secretary, who is, on college campuses, right? Like, this is pervasive everywhere. And it's not just the guys who are assaulting women. It's you and your comments on the street, right? It's the little ways that you perpetuate it, and the thoughts and the comments and the ways that you make women uncomfortable that you may not be aware of, or that you actively may be aware of, that you need to start to work on, because that contributes to, like, men need to hold other men accountable for their behavior. And I think that would go a long way.
Yeah, I agree. All right, last story of the day.
The most important story.
So in case scrolling through Twitter sometimes makes you sad at the state of the world, there's a new conspiracy theory spreading on the site that might bring a smile to your face or make you even more sad. I don't actually know. But apparently some people think that Melania has a body double. Now, this theory was first put forth by a woman on Twitter named Andrea Wagner Barton. And she came up with this theory because of a video that she saw of President Trump speaking next to Melania. Let's take a look at that video.
A very big statement. We will be doing that. My wife, Melania, who happens to be right here, finds that subject to be of such vital importance, and she's very much involved. And as you know, she's on the committee and really wants to be involved in that process. Yes. Yes. They would love me to stay in only for one reason. Look at the kind of money that's being sent. You know, Iran is spending money in various countries. And I've always said it, and I say to them, don't do anything, don't worry about it. Take all the money you can get. They're all friends of mine. Actually, Emmanuel called up and he talked to me.
All right, so who knows? I think it's Melania, but I do enjoy a good conspiracy theory now and then. Now, Andrea Wagner Barton says that she thinks that's a decoy that stood in for Melania, because she wonders why on earth he would say, you know, my wife Melania, who happens to be standing right here.
Mm-hmm. That's me.
That's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I am that person for sure.
Mm-hmm. I think he said it because this is his like feeble attempt at like trying to like be gender aware. Like, I'm not going to speak for her.
Oh,
she's,
yeah, Trump
here.
Is trying to be gender aware.
Well, no,
totally,
I think trying to signal.
Right.
Because that's how I read it. I was like, why not just let her say that she represents this organization? But instead, you're speaking for her yet again.
She always looks like she's hiding.
Yes.
Like,
well, let's look at the image real quick here of her in the sunglasses compared to her not in sunglasses. So it's her, right?
Yes.
I can see why people think it looks different, but it's her.
It's her, yeah.
There are photos. There are photos from later in the day where you see it is obviously Melania wearing the same outfit,
yeah.
But we don't see her take the sunglasses off. So I think once Melania was available, the body double left, and the real Melania came in. The question is, with the glasses,
I think
she wears such heavy glasses.
It's pinching.
They're awesome.
Her.
She looks great.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it's very stylish, but the heaviness of the glasses kind of pushes the nose out.
Yeah.
Or it's just creating like a weird, like shadowy light,
or maybe her
like contour makeup artist just didn't contour her nose that day.
The bevel is shining light on the bridge of her nose. Bevel glare.
No, I think the biggest thing from watching this video is that they are completely not, like, they're not a couple. They're not like attuned to each other. He's like, this is what my speech says, my wife Melania. Oh yes, this is her as well. Like, he doesn't even know how to interact with her in a normal way.
Who loves me very much.
Yes, I paid her a lot to say that.
I don't creep her out like I creep everyone out. No, that's not the case.
Yeah, they don't. The fact that she did the briefing in the sunglasses, I thought was ridiculous.
That was my comment
the whole time. I was like, this is so, like, you are the first lady. Like, you can't just do
she's
what
got,
she
like,
wants.
She's got like a trench coat on and the full sunglasses.
Felt like, okay,
she's going incognito.
Yeah.
She's reading this story and she's like, can we do that?
Yeah, can I get a body double? Because I don't want to stand next to him for however many years.
To be anywhere but near him.
Yeah. That's really good.
Yeah, that's great. That's lovely. All right, guys, that is our show for today. For members, you can stick around and watch the post game, which will be coming up. I don't know what we're going to talk about, but we'll find something fun to talk about. For the rest of you, we will see you tomorrow.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.